Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 19 through 23. All the firstling males that come of thy herd and of thy flock, thou shalt sanctify unto the Lord thy God. Thou shalt do no work with the firstling of thy bullock, nor shear the firstling of thy sheep. Thou shalt eat it before the Lord thy God year by year in the place which the Lord shall choose, thou and thy household. And if there be any blemish therein, as if it be lame or blind or have any ill blemish, thou shalt not sacrifice it to the Lord thy God. Thou shalt eat it within thy gates. The unclean and the clean person shall eat it alike, as the roebuck and as the hart. Only thou shalt not eat the blood thereof. Thou shalt pour it upon the ground as water. Amen. Now this little section is about an all-encompassing principle that is so important to our lives and to the advancement of the Christian church in every age. It is the principle of consecration. I reckon one of the highest honors that could ever be paid to a fellow Christian is when somebody in the church or community says, this man, this woman really is consecrated. He is consecrated. She is consecrated. There would scarcely be a higher honor could be given you, though you wouldn't know if anybody said it, which is best. You wouldn't. I remember in 1966, I was in the seminary and went down to Jackson, Mississippi to work under First Presbyterian Church, and I worked some there, and then they also sent me out on sort of missions to do two different smaller Presbyterian churches in very small towns to help with the youth and some other things, which I greatly enjoyed and remember with pleasure. And I remember going to one of those little towns in Mississippi, sort of rural Mississippi, and that church had a minister. The other one, where I later went, didn't. But this church had a minister, and I remember a number of people, it was pretty well said throughout the community to me when I got there, because you're a younger man will always, he doesn't ask for it if he's a good man, but he will get an assessment given to him of what the senior minister is like. He'll hear. Everybody said around there, Reverend so-and-so is very consecrated. I found it to be absolutely right. I remember somebody saying, perhaps in general, a minister, it the custom that people would bring food to his house. It's fine, nobody criticized that. But this man, he and his wife were constantly taking out food that they cook to poor people and the needy people and sick people. They'd never had a minister that was that generous along with his wife in doing that kind of thing. And he was just a very humble person and full of prayer and just the presence of the Lord. And they say that's 42 years ago. I believe he's still living at a considerable age. And I'll have to say, I would put him and a Lumbee Indian up out from Pembroke, long since with the Lord, a Plymouth Brethren preacher. I would put those as two of the most consecrated people that have ever touched my life and encouraged me to seek the route of consecration. Now, this term that we use it in the Christian church. Wonderful word. Consecration is rooted in the Old Testament. Not least here in Deuteronomy 15:19-23, just read to you. Also, it is in Exodus 13 and Numbers 18, which I won't turn up this morning. So what does this beautiful reality, consecration, really mean as we look in Deuteronomy 15, Exodus 13, Numbers 18, and then we're going to pick it up and I'll show you some passages in the New Testament. Well, to find out what consecration is, let us note 3 points this morning. First, consecration is part of the Sabbath principle. Second, the necessity of being set apart or being made different or put in another category. And then third, consecration as sacrifice after the New Testament. First, consecration as part of the Sabbath principle. That helps us make sense of these requirements. And I've told you before that this section of Deuteronomy, that Deuteronomy is divided in basically is 10 major sections. I mean, there's more than that, but the heart of it is 10 major sections. Each section dealing with expounding one of the 10 commandments, and Moses works through. And we're in the section now, and you've probably forgotten it because seemed like so long ago that I was here. But anyway, the section we're in today, as the last time I was here, whenever it was, is remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. It is this matter of consecration is in the context of the Sabbath principle. That's going to help us understand what consecration really means, to put a handle on it. We could perhaps get hold of. So the Sabbath principle is also a sort of a consecration, a setting apart, but it's in the temporal area. You set apart one day out of every 7. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, and so forth. But the seventh is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it you don't work. You worship, you praise, and of course, you have to engage in acts of necessity and mercy. Get the ox out of the ditch. Take care of the sick and things like that. It's well understood. But one day out of every 7 is to be devoted to God and Him alone. It's the consecration of our time. Some say, well, doesn't all our time belong to God? Yeah, but that's the way to get yourself off the hook. That's not the point. I know everything belongs to God. But the only way you're going to demonstrate consecration of time is give Him one day out of 7. Some people want to go shopping all day Sunday and work on Sunday and say, well, I believe God owns everything. No, you don't believe it if you won't keep one day out of 7. It's interesting to think, isn't it? Yeah, look back on my life now, and getting on up there, that I was brought up to keep the Sabbath day. I couldn't say I've absolutely been perfect in it, but it's been my desire to honor the Lord as best I could. And I'm thinking about it in my 60s. 1/7 of my life, of anybody's life, is brought up in the faith, 1/7 of my life has been spent resting to the Lord in praise and worship and in church. 1/7 of your life, when you come to die, if you've been a real Christian, whatever else could be said about you, 1/7 of every minute you had during this brief earthly pilgrimage was a Sabbath minute. And that's a great thing. So Sabbath keeping is a picture of consecration to God in the area of time. I say this to you. What is the most valuable thing you have? You might say, well, I got to have money to pay my bills. That's true. Money is important. You want to honor the Lord, you want to pay your bills, and you want to be able to help people. So, yeah, money is valuable. But you can lose money and get it back. Something you can't get back is time. The most valuable thing you've got is time. I don't know if I ever told you, but I was reading a few months ago the marvelous genius Albert Einstein when he was at Princeton University in his later years. They had a big banquet in his honor. And somebody said to this amazing man, Dr. Einstein, if you could be given by us a gift that you would really like, what would it be? He said it would be a jar filled with more time. The most precious thing you got, your time. And Sabbath keeping, you're showing God that you're giving something that's very, very precious. Most precious thing you've got, I suppose, is the time. But you can get money back if you lose it. You cannot get time back. It's allotted. You don't get it back. But you can give it to God one day out of seven. Now, so, Sabbath is consecration in the temple area of time. Similarly, the devotion or the consecration or the offering or the setting apart of the firstborn of men and animals to the Lord is a picture of consecration in the area of personal familial life and economic growth. And now the money comes in. It's important. So temporally, we consecrate 1/7 of our time to the Lord every week. But then in terms of human increase and economic increase, Old Testament believers consecrated to God the firstborn of all their cattle and sheep. And then later, not this morning, we're going to take it when we get to Deuteronomy 21, what is the meaning of the consecration of the firstborn son to the Lord. But I'll talk about that another Sunday. I've got enough to handle today. So, second point, the necessity of being set apart or made special. And this section is talking about the economic reality, money, economic growth, and human growth. And is saying that part of it is to be consecrated to the Lord. Now, the major form of wealth in Old Testament times was flocks of sheep and herds of cattle and goats and so forth. Animals. Animal husbandry. That was the principal form of wealth in the ancient world, and it still is in much of the world. I know some of our Gideons from the Dillon camp were, I don't know if it was Africa or somewhere, and they met a really consecrated young man that was a Gideon and looking forward to getting married, but he still had to make enough money to get three more cows to give to his father-in-law or his potential father-in-law to get the hand of this man's daughter. And some of the Gideons said, we'll give you the money to get these extra cows to drive down to your father-in-law's or would-be father-in-law's house. And he said, no, no, the Lord will send it in. I don't want you to give me the money. So many parts of the world, still, the number of animals you have is your wealth. If you read the book of Job, he had a lot, but the main thing is listed how many camels he had, how many sheep, goats, cattle, and so forth. And he was the richest man in that part of the world. I don't know how much you know about your own ancestry, but one thing I found out as I started studying years ago to write that particular book, Carolina Scots, our ancestors left the Argyll in Scotland and Isle of Skye and Jura and Isle and all that and came to North Carolina and then spilled into this part of South Carolina. Why did they come? The Puritans in England came because of religious persecution, but our people came because of the price of cattle. In the Highlands of Scotland, the main form of wealth was cattle. That's one reason Alan and Flora MacDonald, famous, the couple came here. The price of cattle went down so low. And that was a form of wealth. They couldn't pay their debts. Or maybe they did best could. They had to get out while the getting was good. So most of our ancestors, from 1739 on down, the price of cattle was often suddenly falling. You know how it is with cotton. You know how it is with wheat. Commodities can be way up there and then suddenly go down. That's how it was with cattle. And so the Highland Scots, there were other difficulties, but the main thing was that both plagues among the cattle and then the prices falling of what they could sell them to the English markets. And so they decided that they would try it out in the colony of North Carolina, where it happened to be the governor was a Scot. So we are here, most of us in here, some kind of Scot. We are here and not in Scotland because of the price of cattle falling as it did in the from about the 1720s to whatever, 1800, up and down, and mostly down. And so that's how we got here. So what I'm saying, give you all that story, is when you're talking about the increase of animals and what they would bring in the market, that is the form of wealth that most people in the world have lived by since the dawn of time, and many still do. Now, to say that the firstborn of every cow, of every sheep, of every goat, every camel, or what have you, is to be set apart to the Lord, that's a considerable transfer of wealth to God. I mean, you might say, well, this is nothing. Yeah, that's something big. Horse, or what have you. So that's a way of saying, I recognize the goodness of our Creator God, our Savior, our Provider, and I consecrate to Him as He has commanded the firstborn that opens the womb of this cow, of this sheep, of this camel, of this ox, of this horse, or whatever you have. That's consecration. Well, temporal consecration is Sabbath keeping. Material consecration in terms of human life and animal reproduction and husbandry and the basic form of wealth most people live by is part of that being set apart to God. And certain things you can't do with it, but some other things you can do with it. So consecration was expressed negatively and positively. Let's look at those. First, negatively. Firstborn livestock were not to be used to work in the field. Firstborn ox, they're strong. You couldn't use them to work in the field. Firstborn sheep were never to be sheared. You know, get the wool, either to weave it for your own family's clothing or take it to the nearest village or the city to sell it to get a little ready money. You couldn't do that. And not to be worked in the field, not to be sheared for their wool. The firstborn, that is. The rest of them, you could do it. Consecration of the firstborn reminded everybody that these animals are special. They are devoted to God. That's negatively, so you don't do certain things with them. Positively, firstborn animals could be sacrificed at the central shrine of worship, you know, the tabernacle, and later, after Deuteronomy, quite a while later, at the temple in Jerusalem. It was fine to sacrifice a consecrated firstborn animal because, after all, they belong to God. And there's no doubt, as we notice, the setting apart of the firstborn of animals and mankind is a reminder of the Passover. You remember how the 10th plague, when Pharaoh would not let the Israelites go free, and God gave him many a warning, and then the 10th plague was the roughest. The angel of death passed through Egypt, and the firstborn of every family from Pharaoh's palace down to the slave hovel, firstborn son, of every family was slain by the destroying angel of death, and the firstborn of every animal of the cattle, of the sheep, of the camels, and all of that, the firstborn was slain. It would be a tremendous loss in the agricultural husbandry realm. A terrible loss. But the children of Israel were in the land of Goshen. That was a separated part of Egypt. And they had smeared the blood of the sacrificial lamb by divine provision on the doorpost of every house, and the fact that the blood was smeared on the doorpost also protected the barns and the sheep stalls and the cattle stalls, and the destroying angel passed over and did not visit devastation on the sons of the Israelites, nor on their cattle, their sheep, or any of that. They were freed. So, the Israelites remembered that their firstborn had been spared by divine grace, whereas the Egyptians had been taken. Therefore, it was proper for them to consecrate all the rest of their history, at least under the old economy, till Christ would come, to consecrate all their firstborn to the Lord, because they would remember, after all, these are a gift of the Lord. And as I promised you, I don't want to talk about the firstborn of the human family this morning for sake of time, but if I live till we get to the 21st chapter of Deuteronomy, we're going to talk about that a little more thoroughly. Now let me make this final remark under the second point. The requirement that there be no defect in this animal if you take it to be sacrificed. Verse 21, you cannot use the animal to work in the field. You cannot shear the sheep for the wool, but it is appropriate if you want to take it to central shrine for a holy sacrifice, because it belongs to the Lord anyway. However, there is this proviso placed upon it. You do not take a defective animal, that is, malformed or some kind of problem with it that means it's not healthy and not the very best. You do not offer that sort of animal to be sacrificed to God. You only give Him your best. This is commented on in Malachi 1, 6 to 9, which I'm going to read to you. Malachi 1, 6 to 9, the very end of the Old Testament. A son honoreth his father, and a servant his master. If I then be a father, where is mine honor? And if I be a master, where is my fear? Saith the Lord of hosts unto you, O priests that despise my name. And ye say, wherein have we despised thy name? Ye suffer polluted bread upon mine altar, etc. And verse 8, and if ye offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if ye offer the lame and sick, is it not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee? Or accept thy person, saith the Lord of hosts. And now I pray you, beseech God that he will be gracious unto us, and so forth. So, Malachi is saying one of the problems at the end of the Old Testament economy is people bringing junk to the Lord and keep the best for themselves. And that's inviting judgment. You only give of your best to God. I want to read you just a line or two from a wonderful old hymn. Give of your best to the Master. Give of the strength of your youth. Throw your soul's fresh glowing ardor into the battle for truth. Jesus has set the example. Dauntless was he, young and brave. Give him your loyal devotion. Give him the best that you have. And then this verse. Give of your best to the Master. Naught else is worthy his love. He gave himself for your ransom, gave up his glory above, laid down his life without murmur, you from sin's ruin to save. Give him your heart's adoration, give him the best that you have. Give of your best to the Master, give of the strength of your youth, clad in salvation's full armor, join in the battle for truth. And that has been on my mind since I was in my early teens and heard it sung and prayed, Lord, please help me do this. Third, consecration as sacrifice after the New Testament. I would say, I'm not going into all the details, but the law of offering the firstborn of the animals to the Lord does not seem to have been necessary after the incarnation of Christ. He is God's first... What? God's firstborn is Jesus Christ. God gave His firstborn for us. He left the glories of heaven. He is the firstborn. He fulfills all the typical Old Testament requirements. They're honorable, they're right, they're good, they're true. They're fulfilled in Jesus. When the Father offers His own Son on the cross, that fulfills the economy of the firstborn. So it's not required of us now that we offer the firstborn of our sheep and cattle, the few of us that might have them. On the other hand, I want to say the principle of sacrifice and consecration of what you have, or at least part of what you have, carries on in the New Testament. I think the nearest we have, it's not my subject this morning, I dealt with it a few weeks ago, I think. The nearest we have to consecration of the firstborn would be the tithe. And I've spoken of that before and probably will before we end these studies. The tithe is the closest we have to this thing, consecrate the firstborn of animals. But the principle that the way we look at our life in this world and what we do with it to make it really significant and really count, the principle of sacrifice carries over from Deuteronomy 15 and these other passages I've referred to, Numbers 18, Exodus 13, and so forth. Listen to the teaching of the Apostle Paul in Romans 12, the first two verses. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Idea here is that the best that you'll ever have, in principle anyway, say, Lord, I'm willing for you to have it first. You have first refusal. Then if you say, no, son or dear daughter, I don't really need that right now, you can have it back. And then fine. To me, one of the great women of Christianity in the last 300 years was Susanna Wesley. She was the mother of the wonderful evangelist John Wesley and his brother Charles Wesley, the noble hymn writer. What a mother she was. I can't remember how many children she had. Something, 16, 17. And her husband was a very poor Church of England vicar and always struggling, never enough money. But what a fabulous job she did raising those children for the Lord. And one time when Susanna's two sons, or two of her sons, she had several others, but I guess the most outstanding ones would have been John Wesley and Charles Wesley. They had finished Oxford University and been in the Holy Club, and then they felt called to a mission in Savannah, Georgia, colony of Georgia, which was pretty wild at that time. It was a dangerous place to cross the North Atlantic and go somewhere like Georgia. It was still largely a wilderness, lots of Indians, diseases, and so forth. And somebody spoke to Mrs. Susanna Wesley and said, "Ah, Sister Wesley, we feel so sorry for you. Your two most brilliant sons that have done so well at Oxford and had such a bright future before them, that they have gone to the very iffy, dangerous colony of Georgia." And Susanna looked him right in the eye and said, "Look here, I couldn't be more pleased that my sons are consecrating themselves to the Lord in Georgia." She said, "I wish I had 15 more sons and that I could send every last one of them to the mission field, because Jesus Christ deserves the best that I've got. They're the best I've got. I gladly offer them up to the Lord." That's what Mrs. Susanna Wesley said. And her sons, in many ways, came close to changing a large percentage of the English-speaking world. I'd say if we Christian parents felt more that way, there's no telling what we could do on the mission fields of this world. I had us to sing this morning the hymn, O Zion, Haste. I'll just take one line from it. Give of thy sons to bear the message glorious. Give of thy wealth to speed them on their way. Pour out thy soul for them in prayer victorious. And all thou spendest, Jesus will repay. Publish glad tidings, tidings of peace, tidings of Jesus, redemption and release. Now I'm going to conclude with a contrast of two verses about attitude. You hear today somebody say, so-and-so has an attitude problem. You know what they mean. The most important thing about a person is obviously their attitude. How you deal with them in business or in the home or in the social setting. Attitude pretty well determines what you can or cannot do with them. Attitude. Now, it's two different attitudes. One you have in the world, which to say to that point before it's touched with the grace of God. Worldly attitude. And worldly attitude is not whether somebody smokes, drinks, or dances, or wears makeup, or silly external things. That's not what it is to be worldly. Worldly attitude is this. And you'll find it in what Satan says to God in Job chapter 2, verse 4. And Job accuses the Lord of protecting, Satan, the evil one, accuses the Lord of protecting Job too much. Say, Job, put a hedge about him. Of course he praises you and honors you. You don't let anything bad happen to Job. He doesn't really love you, he just loves what you give him. That's what Satan says to God. And then Satan summarizes the attitude of the world and the people under his control, which Job was not, actually. Job was not. But Satan hoped he would be. Yea, skin for skin, all that a man hath will he give for his life. Now get that. Here's worldliness. Here's the attitude of the world and those that don't even know it, that they're under Satan's dominion. Skin for skin, everything that a man has will he give for his life. In other words, put yourself first. Break any and every moral principle if you can stay on top and protect yourself. Take care of number one. And let moral considerations go if it's necessary to protect your interest. That is natural to a fallen world. Of course it is. What's it like? What is the attitude of the true church, of the saved man and woman? Revelation 12:11. Revelation chapter 12, verse 11. This is the attitude of God's people. This is consecration. This is consecration. That's what it means. We're taking it from Deuteronomy 15, and then through Romans 12, and then Revelation 12, verse 11. And they overcame him, the devil, by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they loved not their lives unto the death. And then goes on and said, rejoice, hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Many in the world are going to praise God and rejoice. If you got some people that are consecrated enough not to love their life to the death, nobody in good sense wants to get killed or put themselves unnecessarily in a way of danger. That's not right. But when God says, dear son, dear daughter, serve me here. Don't ask any question. Do what I say. And they say, Lord, I love you. Jesus gave everything for me. You've got the right to ask me my best, and I'll go. I go in this difficult situation. And the mission of the church has worked for 2,000 years. We're still much larger than Islam, by the way, and we're expanding more rapidly than Islam. Some of the media is giving wrong information on that. Actually, Islam is big. Christianity is bigger. It's expanding more rapidly. And it's expanding because you've had the men and women over the ages that loved not their lives unto the death. It's fine to enjoy living, to appreciate the good creative gifts of God in your family and good food and drink and friendship, and it's fine. But don't love it to the death. Don't love living so much that you violate moral principle and forget who God is. No, you love Christ better than your life. And when a selfish world sees that Christians are consecrated, that they put the interest, the honor of Christ and the interest of others before self, it absolutely shocks the world. Sometimes it shocks open the iron gates to their hearts. They can't believe that somebody's not finally, totally self-centered and selfishly motivated. They care for God, they honor God, and they care for them. And it is such a shock to the worldly mind that it has broken many a one open to receive the love and the light of the grace of God in Jesus Christ. To just conclude by saying the secular world can never be won. Somebody say, what in the world are we going to do? Politics is awful and secularism is worse. What can we do? Well, I don't know other than this. The most important thing we can do is be consecrated Christians. You say, yeah, but I ask you a political question. I ask you a cultural question. You've given me an answer of piety. Well, I was reading, don't discount consecration as changing the real world. I was reading recently about Gorbachev. And Gorbachev is now a member of the Christian church, the form they have of it in Russia, the Russian Orthodox Church. Gorbachev is a member. He was the biggest politician in the time that Ronald Reagan and Maggie Thatcher, those were the big ones. And he was head of an atheistic communist nation. The big place. The powerful place that defined our policy from the 1940s. And Gorbachev has joined the church. Why? I don't know all the reasons, but it was said in the article I was reading, he had very consecrated grandparents and a consecrated mother. And he never forgot that consecration when he was heading up the Soviet Union. And it may have had something to do with the fact that he worked for it to sort of unravel for more freedom. I can't say. But he seemingly is on the Lord's side. Now, I remember when he came to North Carolina in Charlotte, whatever, maybe 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, and one of the things he requested, it was in the Charlotte Observer, to be taken up to visit Billy and Ruth Graham. I don't know whether they actually could work that into the trip, but that is what Gorbachev requested. All right, now, so there you see, consecration. Humble grandparents, humble mother. And biggest politician of the 20th century, one of the biggest. It changed him. Consecration. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to Thee. Take my moments and my days. Let them flow in ceaseless praise. Take myself and I shall be ever only all for Thee.